Welcome everyone to another episode of the Unbalanced Notes. Oh my gourd, it is the start of the year 2021. I'm Brian Kluger and I'm joined by the host with the most, the man who I love to listen to and make music with all the movies, the televisions, Mark Chaffardini. How's it going, buddy?
I'm doing superb. Thank you for that intro. I got all the instruments to make all the musics for you, Brian's.
Oh, thank you. I'm so happy you have all the instruments, but we have a very special episode on the Unbalanced Note today. Oh my, all the way, I believe, from the West Coast, we have an intercontinental champion of music, composing, of television and movies, and of course, the album Leaf. Oh, let's welcome Jimmy LaValle. Welcome to the show.
That is epic. I love it.
I'm getting my pro wrestling on here. Right. So. We're going to speak in terms of pro wrestling through the whole time. So just
Sounds good.
So
yeah, I do have a pro wrestling fan actually of my music. It is out there. He has professed his appreciation for my music.
Can you say who
Finn,
it is? Yeah,
it's Finn Balor.
Oh, Finn Balor. Love him. Yeah. The demon.
Yeah, totally. It's kind of it was a trip, but we've communicated like through the years. He even has like Leaf printed wrestling, like what would it gear, you know, like the little Speedo and the shin guards and all the stuff with Leafs printed on it. It's pretty amazing.
That's amazing. I love it. That's great. So we're going to get into all sorts of fun stuff with your career and life. But first, we have to start at the beginning. Where did it all begin for you in music? Where was it something you heard on the radio? Did your parents play your record? Where did it all begin for you in music?
I mean, it's not really super, it's not super clear like where it began, but it's like, I have different, I guess, moments that, resonate because, and I say that just because I started playing, when I was four. I was in piano lessons when I was four. And then the trajectory from that just kind of continued. In third grade, I started playing violin. There was a program where, the elementary school kids could go to the middle school, high school or middle school band and orchestra on like one day a week. And so I started playing violin and traveling to the middle school to play with the middle school orchestra. Fourth grade, I started playing clarinet as well as violin. So I was still doing the middle school thing. And then when I got to middle school, I continued with violin and clarinet until I basically kind of fell in love with the percussion section. And in sixth grade, I started in the drum line, as fourth bass drum, which for anyone who's not unfamiliar, it's basically, the one of any, you know, it just comes down like one, boom, two, three, four, you know, like you're just that, and there's nothing like, you know, complex about it. You just hit that downbeat. And then, in seventh grade, I started playing in the jazz band of the middle school, on piano. And then, in eighth grade, I was full force percussion section. And then moving into high school, I, was kind of scouted by the high school to come and join their drum line. So I was the freshman snare drum, on an all senior line, so just like the drumline movie, like that movie, like that was exactly what I was doing, drum corps and marching and, you know, in uniform and all that kind of stuff. And then from that, the seniors graduated. I then took over as captain of the drum percussion section, in 10th grade. And from there, I kind of just met like the rowdiest cast of characters that were all in the percussion line. It was like, we were all the misfits, you know? And that's when I kind of through those, like, moment, like through those couple of years is when I started kind of discovering music and really taking like an interest in like performing and being in a band and learning this, and taught myself how to play guitar. And one of the other guys in the percussion line was a bass player, and he and I started playing guitar and he was a bass player. And so we kind of, you know, just these kinds of different things, and that kind of just kind of naturally led into, interest in performing in a band and being in a band, and then essentially quitting band and orchestra in 10th grade or after my sophomore year. So my junior and senior year, I was just like a a guy in a band. It really bad music and, you know, all that stuff. It was mid-90s and, you know, there's a lot of like grunge influence and stuff like that. And then in my senior year of high school, I discovered, I started junior and senior year, but both, I started to discover like more underground DIY stuff, like, you know, starting first with, you know, the more popular like Fugazi, and then moving down into kind of just the local scene that was happening around San Diego and kind of falling into that. And it was kind of an underground hardcore scene, punk scene more so. Hardcore is kind of the wrong word to explain because it's kind of gone in such a personally just like a direction that's not what I was doing at all. Anyhow, and then that kind of like exposed me to the world of like DIY ethics and just like, you know, it's what established my, you know, just my kind of moral views and my views as a person, and just kind of turned me in really into who I was. And with that, I started also touring. My first tour was in my senior year of spring break. I went out to Michigan and back in the span of a week in a van full of, you know, 8 other people. We were all crammed in there and 3 people on the loft, super unsafe the entire time. No seatbelts, just like how how my parents was like, you know, didn't not let me do that. What, you know, was pretty great. But, you know, that kind of like led into, you know, me then, you know, that summer was my first tour in Europe, my first tour across the States, you know, those kinds of things. And I was 18. So it just kind of like opened me up to that world of, you know, and I was playing punk and hardcore music. And then I met a guy a cast of characters in that first spring break tour. And we really kind of like hit it off just musically. And then they ended up moving out to San Diego. And then he and I started kind of, you know, we were roommates and we were discovering alternate tunings and guitar and, you know, and all in all, like I was making really mellow music while playing punk and hardcore music. But, you know, at some point I just kind of quit doing that and then started kind of on the trajectory of like the music that I'm creating still now. And then, you know, there's a bunch of parts and pieces from then to now, but pretty much that kind of sets me into kind of who I am.
That's wonderful.
Short story long.
No, I like it. I like these long stories. I want to go back to the elementary school when you said you started on violin. Now, is that an instrument that you picked or was somebody else picked for you to play?
I think that was... my memory is that you could only do, like there was only a couple of things you could choose from. And, I believe that was, it was like brass or clarinet or it was like brass. Yeah. Something like that. I don't know. I ended up being on violin. I'm not really clear as to like if I chose it specifically or not, but I mean, obviously I was, and I was taking lessons and all that kind of stuff. So yeah.
Do you remember the first song you learned?
No idea.
And then, yeah. And so going from violin to clarinet, so I played clarinet and saxophone through sixth grade through.
Nice. Did you march? Now. Did you march too?
I did march. I did.
I marched. I have a photo of me marching clarinet. It's pretty awesome.
But. It's pretty great.
Yeah. It's an easy instrument. So you just, you know, it's like, doesn't weigh much and you just kind of,
it does not.
Roll. Yeah.
So did you have trouble? I mean, it seems like you've been working like kind of almost like a child star since you were young and, you know, playing with older people and even touring it, you know, before 18, basically. Do you find it hard to pick up an instrument such as from violin, strings to something like clarinet, or does it just come naturally and organic even at that age?
I feel like it was natural. And I mean, I have kids, so I kind of see how they're basically kind of my age, the same age I'm talking about, kind of getting into all of music, and I can see how they are kind of just sponges and things kind of come a little bit easier. So I feel like, I mean, obviously, I feel like you're musical or you're not really, you know, and it can be easy, or it can come naturally, I guess, to you. And I think that that's kind of like what I had going on. It was just kind of, you know, it came naturally. And I have like, you know, superior like stickers all over my like cases. Like I still have my clarinet and stuff. So like from performances, you know, and like doing the recitals and stuff and the grading and things like that. So, yeah, But yeah, I mean, I don't have a memory of anything being difficult. I do remember why I stopped playing clarinet, though, is because the taste of the reed made my stomach hurt in the morning and something weird like that. And that's a memory that I have. And then also why I stopped playing violin was the, you know, like a miss stroke of the bow, like gave me just incredible, like the nails on the chalkboard feeling. And that kind of like gave me like those two thoughts, like just, or memories, like are really visceral. And I just remember that. And it really kind of stuck with me. And then of course the, you know, being a drummer is just so cool, you know?
Yeah.
So I was always like playing, like looking back at the drum section and percussion section being like, I want to do that, you know? So all the cool sounds coming out of there, like, you know, like just like the vibra slaps and just the wood blocks and, you know, deeper than just like, you know, snare and bass and stuff like that and timpanis. And, you know, it's really cool.
That's funny because, you know, we hear stories all the time about parents of a musician. They're like, okay, we want him to be a doctor and a lawyer, but the music thing's just for now. And then they become and make a whole career out of it. Were your parents like that? Or when you started doing percussion, were like, oh God, we hope this is a phase because it's loud, or were they really supportive?
No, they bought me a drum set. They bought me a Kima drum set. It was like the cheapest, like, and I had it, I put it in my room. And I remember learning how to play drums specifically. Like I it's like very clear because I taught myself how to play drum set, and kind of like my coordination and figuring that all out. But I spent a summer with my dad, traveling in our RV, like just through the Southwest, just he and I. And when we were driving, I would, you know, I had a Walkman back then. And I would just listen to, I had tapes and I listened to, Led Zeppelin, Lenny Kravitz, Mama Said, and Faith No More's Angel Dust. Three incredibly different records. But I air drummed in the back the entire time. So I just would be in the back and like practice, like that's how I learned, was just air drumming in the back seat, and came back and it then clicked, you know, because I remember there's a fill in stair, or not a, it's not even a fill. It's just a rhythm in Stairway to Heaven. Where it's just, it's like, that part, the hi-hat snare, like communication there, like I could never get it. And then before that road trip, I couldn't figure out how to like, just like free up my left hand from my right hand. And, on that, I just like got it and came back and then started, and that was it. But yeah, the entirety, my parents were always supportive. You know, we had a piano in the house, and I was always in music lessons, and, whenever I wanted to stop, they would let me stop. Cause that's kind of like, I grew up playing piano, but I took like a year when I was four, I took a year at 6 months when I was seven, I went back when I was 12, and then I went back again when I was like 17. And that was like it. So I was always able to stop and start and do whatever I kind of wanted musically. So that's, I'm thankful for that for sure.
Great. I'm still weirded out about a four-year-old playing piano because my daughter is 5 and a half, and the number of things without putting her down, the number of things she's not coordinated with, I can't, how do you go about teaching a four-year-old such a complex instrument?
My son just started piano lessons last week. He's seven. And I was looking at it like, and I think the same thing, like, I mean, obviously I wasn't, the virtuoso or anything like that at four, but I do remember going, he taught lessons in his garage. He was this older gentleman. He, had some weird whistle when he said S's. And those are my memories of it. And then also literally just playing things like, you know, probably just right hand, like Home on the Range and Row, Row, Row the Boat, you know, stuff like that. I think was when it started. And my daughter is four. And I can see her having the focus. And I think it's just really the focus really, cause my son is all over the place, but he does, like, his mind is always racing. He's always thinking of something. He's so imaginary, and like for him to stop and focus, you know, he can do it. He is that, he can totally do it, but, I don't know. I can, it didn't last long when I was four, you know. I stayed there at four, and then I kind of like went in and I don't know, continued on something else. But I do think about that, like, because I do have a there's a guy I played in a band with too that are that said he started when he was two, and I'm like, come on, dude, two? You could, like, you didn't start when you were two. Maybe you like say, I don't know. You know, like, it's like, I started playing piano when I was two. It's like, well, everybody started playing piano when they're like realistically, if you're hitting a piano, I guess you started playing piano, but like two, come on. But
have played me like
four
a
is
scale.
Cool. Four is totally fine. Two, no, I don't know. Yeah. That's kind of a funny argument, I guess, but
I had heard that your brother played piano and guitar.
Exactly.
I wonder if it's different when children have siblings, you know, someone who's closer to their age that they can kind of emulate or work.
Yeah. I had two, like my brother was 6 years older than me. And then my uncle, was a ragtime piano player, and he would come over and play piano for me, and I would just blow my mind. It's like, you know, like just the really fun ragtime piano. And I think that was also really inspiring. So I think that there's that. And then it's kind of funny. Like my kids have grown up with me. I have a studio. My kids have grown up, obviously, you know, I have a studio in the house. There's music. There's everything available. They come in here, they play, we like record and do some fun stuff. And, you know, I've sampled my son and turned him into instruments and, you know, all these kinds of things, but they haven't really. I was doing a lot. I'm doing a live stream next week, actually, a live stream performance. And I was listening to songs to like kind of make a set list. And they were like, oh, Daddy, did you write this song? Did you play? How did you do that? You know, just all these things. So it kind of feels like they didn't really, you know, they haven't put it together that like I can play music, you know. And my son just got a guitar for Christmas. And in the last couple nights, and I used to do this when they were really young, but for like the last week, I've been playing guitar to each of them as they go to bed. And I mean, it goes good or bad. They either pay attention, fall asleep, or they just like, you know, want a book or whatever, you know. But the point is that like it just didn't click with them that I think that they realize like what it is that you're doing musically, you know. So I'm interested to see how that kind of unfolds now that they're a little more paying a little closer attention. I guess I'm relating that to seeing my brother play both piano and guitar. And my dad actually played guitar a little bit. It was his guitar that was in the house. And then my uncle playing ragtime piano. So it probably does help.
What songs do you play them to go to bed? And could we possibly market a Jimmy LaValle bedtime guitar melody or something?
I don't know. I've been playing like... I remember, so I have this memory when David Bowie died. My son was like three or two or three. I can't remember exactly what year he died. I think it's like 3 years ago, maybe. Anyways, and my son is obsessed with space. So I have this app where we can like, I don't know if you've ever done this. It's pretty incredible that you can go outside and watch the International Space Station go through the sky. It's like crystal clear. It's like, looks like a star just like moving really like steadily across the sky. It's pretty incredible. And so, you know, like all kids obsessed with space, you know, that kind of thing once they've kind of discovered it. But because of that, and around when David Bowie died, I started singing, like I would, like when he was crying or, you know, putting him to bed, I would like kind of hum him Space Oddity and, you know, sing that. And then now recently I've been playing that on guitar for them. Simon and Garfunkel, some Radiohead songs, kind of all over the place, you know, just like anything that like I can kind of like hum, or I don't know, just kind of like quietly play and sing. I mean, nothing really, but I think it's just kind of like my son, now that he has a guitar and it's his and he sees me play it, he actually like looks at me like, oh, like watches my fingers. The tricky thing though is that he's left-handed, so he's gonna have to swap everything. But yeah.
Well, great. Yeah, so maybe he should get him some Paul McCartney videos, because isn't he left-handed?
Paul McCartney is left-handed. Yeah. Oh, okay. Jimi Hendrix, obviously, and yeah, I know. I've actually, as a musician, I've been thinking like, how am I going to like, how do we foster this as a left-handed, you know, like all the little things. It's, but I think it's going to be great. I think we'll just flip his strings around and, it might even be easier to like play it. Cause the other thing is I can't teach them. Like I've discovered that too, that I can't like be the one to be the teacher. I'd rather be the fun reinforcement. Like, you know, here, I just learned this in piano today, and I can be like, oh, cool. And like play that with him. Or when he starts guitar lessons, which he's starting soon, the same kind of thing, you know, where like, I kind of feel like in a way, like, because I remember like playing guitar back and forth with like my, you know, with old bandmates and stuff like that, that, you know, you're facing each other like that. And so you're kind of opposite, but if you're left-handed, you're the same. So it's easier to kind of explain in the fingering, cause you're looking right at a mirror image and putting your thumb, you know, fingers right on it. So it's just one thought. I haven't tested that theory yet, but that's a thought that I had. They're like, oh, that could be cool. You know, we could kind of play back and forth, and that would be, you know. And my brother's actually an excellent guitarist. I'm thinking about that too. Like he's like one of those, like he can solo and do all the, like, you know, he's in a cover band, and the stuff that they were playing is just like really, really cool. Side note, I guess, but.
Well, before we get into the album leaf, I was curious. So you have two album leaf tattoos?
Oh yeah, I do. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So single album leaf. What's the purpose for having two of them? Is it personal to you, or what's the story?
Yeah, they're personal, I guess. Obviously personal, but the one in my inner arm, this one is the old leaf, I guess. So this artist, this first appeared on the Seal Beach. A leaf, as far as incorporating a leaf into the artwork, didn't first appear until my fourth or fifth EP or something, or release. And this artist from San Diego named Rich Sanderson put the leaf in there, and that's when that first appeared. And that was coincidentally the record before In a Safe Place, the EP before that. And then, so that's kind of the original leaf. And then the one that everyone knows now first appeared on In a Safe Place. And that, you know, obviously is just kind of my branded logo at this point. So I was just, I had it tattooed.
Cool. So it's a way of tying this into Synchronic. It's like, you know,
right.
Tells us a story about yourself. Okay. Well, thanks for sharing.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool.
So, was there a particular moment, that you were able to step back and say, hey, the album leaf, this is something special?
Yes, there was. In 97, I started a band called Tristezza, where I played guitar. And it was like a 5-person band. We, you know, the guitarist and I were the main songwriters. And that was kind of like my thing, you know, like that was Tristezza was the band. And we, you know, toured and, excuse me, you know, that was my post-hardcore band, and like touring and doing, you know, the whole thing, going to Japan, going to Europe, you know, doing like, you know, just like my first thing, or real thing that kind of felt, you know, like music that I would like stood behind. And then I obviously play piano, and songs that I wrote on guitar that wouldn't work for Tristezza, I eventually translated to piano, and that kind of was how Album Leaf was born. Recording in my bedroom 4-track on my 4-track recorder, and kind of like, you know, not losing those songs that I wrote and creating them and putting them on piano on Rhodes. Specifically, I guess, so there's a part in there where I played drums for this band called Go 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 Earhart in San Diego, and the singer, his name was Mike Vermillion, had a Rhodes in his living room where we rehearsed. And after Go 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 rehearsals, I would then go over and start noodling on the Rhodes. And that was when I started to translate guitar songs that I wrote for Tristezza onto the Rhodes. And then he was recording me kind of unknowingly on his 8-track recorder. And that kind of became my first record. So it was kind of like, before that I was like, I only had guitar, so I would like make these really. I'm actually this fan who's become now a friend, actually has the first tape I released in 1997. And it's just all these kind of funny guitar songs that I did on 4-track, which predates my my first actual record. But anyhow, so the Album Leaf kind of was born out of a label that, you know, Tristezza had interest from a lot of indie labels, underground labels. And we ended up going with one, you know, and I was dealing with this, so I made connections with a lot of different people, but we had like a unified choice of which label to go with. And then there was a guy that I really resonated with. His name was Darren Gardner, and he had a label from called Music Fellowship. And we're interested in Tristezza, and basically, you know, we decided to go with something else. But then I was like, hey, but I have this record if you are interested in that. And that's kind of how my first solo record was released. and then it was released on CD. And then that first record of Tristezza kind of like got us a little bit, you know, more like, you know, notoriety and just kind of like, you know, getting, you know, coming up in the underground, you know, indie scene. And we were picked up by a label called, and then there's a new startup in New York called InSound, that was kind of like the first like online retailer, like music retailer that was like, just made sense. You know, you could go there and just, you know, buy a Death Cab for Cutie record or a, you know, a Bright Eyes record or just whatever. Like you could just look at the internet was like starting, you know, and you could just buy it online and then it, you know, got mailed to you and they had a big warehouse and stuff. And we did and they also had this side thing called the Tour Support Series. And so they would basically like reach out to bands that were touring. You recorded, you paid for your recording, you supplied them a recording. They pressed up a CD, they gave you 500, they kept the other 500 and sold them on the site, but they gave you those for free and you could sell them on tour. And, you know, it was a way to kind of support yourself and have something to sell on the road. Anyhow, that kind of turned them into starting an actual label. And so that was Tiger Style. And when they signed Tristezza, they were also interested in signing my solo stuff, Album Leaf. And that was kind of what started me into, you know, kind of more, you know, kind of just having my own voice in the scene and also starting to do Album Leaf tours. And aside from Tristezza tours, so I'd go on solo tours and played like South by Southwest. Tristezza was out there. I kind of like, you know, wrangled up and did my little solo set somewhere else or something like that. And then, so one day I'll be on Time was released on Tiger Style, and that ended up in the hands of, in a record store in Iceland. And that's when Jonsi from Sigur Rós picked up that record. They were about to start their first, you know, States tour. It's either their first or second. I believe it was their first, but, so they were, you know, trying to find support for the tour, and, they came across that record, reached out to me. Asked if I'd be interested in supporting. At that time, I had no clue and had never heard of Sigur Rós and didn't know, you know, what they were about. And went online and saw this video of them performing. I forget the song, but it's at the Opera House, and it's just like it was incredible. So I was really excited about that, obviously. And then basically, I did that tour in 2001. Tour started 10 days after 9/11, which was pretty intense. And did that tour, immediately kind of like felt like I should, like, you know, because all of a sudden I was in front of like, you know, 500 to like 2,000 people a night or something like that, you know, 2,000 in the bigger cities, like, or 1,000 in the New Yorks and the Boston and Chicago, etc. And so I was thinking like, okay, cool, I'm gonna go right back out on tour when I get back and kind of capitalize on the exposure that I just had, hit all those same cities, you know, stuff like that. And that tour wasn't that great. The follow-up tour, the Sigur Rós tour, was amazing. But then the follow-up tour I did right after wasn't really that great. So I kind of didn't, like, you know, put all my eggs in that basket like right away. Tristezza was still going, we were playing. And then I did another tour with Sigur Rós, fast forward, you know, 2003, started making another record, which was In a Safe Place. During that tour, signed with Sub Pop. And after that was really the turning point where I was like, okay, I'm going to focus on Album Leaf solely. And then it's kind of just been an upward trajectory since then, since releasing that record on Sub Pop, really. And, you know, the tours with Sigur Rós. So that was the moment.
that was the moment. That is a pretty incredible story. And, you know, while you're saying, you know, stuff like in 97, 98, you know, I was like 17 or 18 then. And so just thinking like even 9/11, I was like, oh my God, it's like 20 years ago. It's hard to believe. And talk about like how long you've been in this business. So that's really cool that you've had all this opportunity and the Sigur Rós and doing that. So being involved in all these aspects, what would be your most go-to or your favorite part of the music business? Is it simply creating, writing a new piece, starting from scratch, or is it kind of the business side? What do you like, or actually playing on stage?
Definitely not the business side. I think just the process of creating music is always what's really resonated and spoke to me. Performing it as well, especially with Album Leaf, because I have, you know, all these layers and things that I do on my own, and figuring out how to perform that and create that and present that has always been really kind of something I love, you know, how to like put a show together, what I'm triggering with one note. And, you know, cause I try to play as much as I possibly can play, and not have, you know, things in tracks. You know, there's only so much I can do when I'm solo, but when I have a band, there's a lot we can do. And I try to kind of like figure out, you know, we use a lot of like live looping on stage and you know, our bass player doubles as a trumpet player and the violinist can also play guitar and do keyboards and sing and things like that. So, it's always been a really exciting thought and process of like putting together a show, designing the show, thinking about how the show's going to look. When it all comes down to it, like definitely just the art of creating music has always been I'm constantly creating music. I have so much that I haven't released and I'm sitting on, and things that I just forget about and move on, or, you know, that's still like my passion is just to make music and create music from, you know, from the ground up, I guess.
And when you're in the Album Leaf, when was the spark to get into the visual medium with music?
That goes back again to the Sigur Rós tour. Touring with Sigur Rós was it was an exposure to the side of performance that I wasn't ever aware of. You know, before that, it was just like so DIY and just like playing in, you know, I mean, clubs with like actual sound systems and things like that, but like not really knowing what, or not really thinking about what else can be done when you're performing. So, you know, that first Sigur Rós tour that I did, they had a really simple visual light setup. They toured, they had a lighting engineer. They had the lighting engineer also ran the video. And that was a thought of like, oh, this is, you know, it was an operation. There was a team, you know, and I couldn't afford a team at that point. You know, I can only even still only afford a certain amount of a team, but basically that kind of like, and because of that, and because of not being able to afford a team, I knew that we were touring with Sigur Rós again, and I thought it could be really cool to have just like a visual element to the show. So it started out with literally just having like a 30, 45 minute loop, video loop, because our set was only 30 minutes long, opening for them. So that just projected, we just asked if they could project it, and we gave them a DVD and they projected it. You know, their visual engineer did it. So that was kind of the beginning. And then after that, I thought, okay, well, you know, can get like colored bulbs, or, you know, and like put two pieces of plywood together in a way that like looks like, you know, I don't know. It's kind of funny. I don't know if anybody's seen the Selena series on Netflix.
Yeah.
You did, okay. Well, you saw the scene where they're like digging through dumpsters to get cans.
Yes.
And then
yes.
They took the cans out and they spray painted the cans and put lights inside of it and rigged them and like made their own like lighting rig. And that was not too far from what I did myself in those early days because of not having, you know, the means and the access to getting, to hiring people to do that stuff. I mean, there's people I collaborated with to give me the content, you know? But that was kind of the beginning of like really thinking about how to present a show. And then for a while, you know, as once I signed with Sub Pop and I started to kind of get, make a little bit more money, I started to bring a visual lighting engineer on tour, and he focused more on visual. We would kind of more so play in the dark and just kind of be lit by the visual. But he every now and then would, you know, whatever house lights were available, maybe like flicker them or do something like that. But then basically kind of like that naturally grew into kind of what I do now. And now I'm, you know, well, I went through times where I would just play to playback and you know, hit play and literally would just play along. So everything was really synced and really on, you know, on point, but it was a very kind of, and the shows was presented great. I mean, when you saw the show, you saw the music, the records you heard, and they were played, you know, as they were recorded and it was there. But there wasn't really any kind of natural feeling to it. It was like, for us at least, you know, playing, probably seeing it, it's fine. You probably don't even know that we're like kind of constrained to this timeline that we have to keep up with. And if you mess up, you got to walk over and hit stop and scroll over and restart, you know, that kind of thing. But it turned into like, once the visual guy stopped touring with us, he had a baby. Once he started a family, he stopped touring. Then I was able to kind of like put the visual underneath the main stereo file that we played along to. So it was always synced, you know, just hit play. And then that kind of made me think like, oh, I actually don't need to bring this person on tour. Like I can do it here. And then I wanted to incorporate lights. So then we found this program that, it's called DMXs, that allows you to write your own lighting scenes and programming, and it rolls through the timeline as well and hits all these different like MIDI triggers and then triggers these different looks. So then that's kind of how I was able to then incorporate lights without having an actual lighting engineer, because the computer just kind of was projecting and hitting all the cues and doing it all on its own. And then I discovered Ableton and performing with Ableton. I mean, since I've always been a looper, like I've hardware looper, like I use a Headrush and a Boss RC20 and those kinds of things live, and I would do it. And as I said earlier, we were always playing to a timeline. So that's kind of how I looped. I had a click and would loop, and I just knew where all my loop points and stuff like that. So because of that, someone introduced Ableton to me early on, and it kind of didn't make any sense to me at that point. But later in the kind of, you know, like 2013, I think is when I discovered it. And that was from making a record with this singer songwriter. We were planning on touring it, and he didn't want to be confined to, he was played shows with a guitar. And so for him, everything was like a vibe every night. Like it was natural, you know? So it was how he responded to whatever was going on. And we were making an electronic record, obviously, and he wanted to have that freedom. So that's kind of how I stumbled into using Ableton, which is now my main weapon, basically. But and then within Ableton, then I could like get into actually triggering scenes and having control over what we actually played live and when. And then once I kind of peeled those layers of the onion of Ableton and found my way in it, it's kind of, I was just off to the races and was able to do so much. So, you know, hitting points in the song where I would set loop points so the music would be looping and we could do whatever we wanted. And I could feel, you know, I basically was now in control of the computer. You know, the computer was part of the band as opposed to us being kind of, you know, tied to it, having to keep up with it. So, and all that to say, I mean, this is a long-winded answer to how did you incorporate visuals, but I mean, that's basically like, because of that, I was able to then, you know, incorporate like the night, then Ableton could talk to another computer and trigger visuals. And so it was like, things were separate. And it was all basically over MIDI that I could like incorporate lights, and having that knowledge and just kind of production design, collaborating with other people on production design, that then just kind of like, you know, it's always something I'm thinking of and what I can do. And I know that I can trigger it all myself and do it myself. So now it's just always been a very, very important element of the show for me, because my, like, going back to like the main reason is like everybody goes, well, not nowadays, but everybody goes to shows in the same room, you know, whatever, how many times a month, and sees all their different favorite bands or new bands or whatever. But like, you know, one thing never changes is the fact that like you're watching in this same space that you're familiar with, you know, the people on stage change when you're, or the band on stage changes. But nothing else really changes. It's the same lighting people all the time. It's the same this. So for me, it was really important to kind of come in and create a new environment and kind of try to just really focus on making a like a unique experience that, you know, would stand out from everything else.
Very cool.
Do you have a favorite country that you enjoyed, you know, being blown away with the first time you went, or Japan?
Japan, yeah.
Oh,
Japan and Asia in general, but Japan is. I started touring in Japan, and my first tour was in 2000, and it was just the. I mean, the first time you go to Japan, you're just like, wow, this is different, you know. Especially back then, it was like, it felt like Blade Runner. It's like I was just like. You know, culture shock, like just, you know, all of the above. I mean, not shock, just culture. Not, shock's a bad word to use actually in that sense, that sentiment, because I was just like culture amazed, really. More so just like taking everything in, just being completely just in awe of everything, you know. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Well, great. Yeah, the first time I went to Japan, I've gone a number of times, but the first time I went was between for New Year's on 2003 to 2004. Nice. And it was like you say, it's a learning experience. It's just so different. Do fans react? I mean, like, how do you maybe gear a show or gear a performance to a different audience or different culture? Is there any changing it up based on where you go?
I mean, I try to, now I have a little bit more, freedom to kind of like put together specific shows and specific set lists. Back then I kind of like, back when we would just kind of play to playback, it was a little less, there was a little less wiggle room. So I kind of like came up with a show that was based on the record and then would kind of just go through and play that show in each country that we went to. And now I know that certain songs are more popular here. Certain songs are, you know, the things like that. So I'll kind of cater to both things that I want to play or I want to do, or, you know, so, stuff like that. But I mean, for the most part though, it's touring the same show, you know, to the elements are there, but, you know, changing up the set list, you know, can keep it fresh.
Sigur Rós, more or less, like you said, discovered you and took you on tour. So who discovered you and said, I think that the album Leaf belongs in film and TV? What was that threshold that you crossed?
yeah. So in 2000, when was that? Basically, so it's funny when I think about it, because for the longest time, I never paid attention to the composer or thought about the composer or thought that there was a composer or like any of that, like up until, I mean, I'm going to say as late as like 2006, 7, 8, you know, like those times, like I'd never really paid attention, you know. I had a lot of success in the licensing world. So all of my, like, for instance, every single song on In a Safe Place was used in that series, the OC television series. And before that, I had like a song in a commercial. And what's funny about the composer comment that I just made was that I was also making music for jingles, like commercials. I was worked in a music house. So that was a composer in a music house, but I still didn't like put it together. Like as far as like the film and TV world, I put it together for commercials, but not for, you know, creating, not for scoring an entire film or something. So I had a lot of success in the licensing world with a lot of my music, just, you know, and I just continued on that. I was a band and I was an artist, you know, making records. My records were licensed to get placements in film and TV, et cetera, et cetera. And then in 2000, I want to say 8 or 9, I played a show in Albuquerque, New Mexico. The band that we were playing with, the bass player played in this other band this Italian band that I knew. These Italian people, it's kind of a legendary Italian, the Sicilians folk that have this band, and they bring people over, you know, small world kind of connection that we made. And he was like, hey, my friend made this documentary. She's been, you know, following this little girl with Apert syndrome, you know,
Tori's Distraction, right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
I was an editor on Tori's Distraction with Tisha Blood.
Well, there you go. So Matt,
yeah,
you know, yeah. So Matt, I forget what band he was in, came up and said, he was basically, they were playing a show with Album Leaf, they're supporting us. And he came up and said, hey, my friend, you know, Tisha, has been following this little girl for 13 years and making this documentary. She lives down the street. She has this rare condition, et cetera, et cetera. Here's the cut. Like, they have a lot of your music temped in, gave me a DVD, and in that tour, I just popped it in my, you know, computer and was watching it. I was blown away by the content, by the you know, by her, Tori, by just the story, you know, as obviously, you know, you're an editor, so that's a coincidence. So anyways, and when I got back, I followed up with Tisha and was like, you know, this was a really incredible film. And I thought, why don't you let me score it? Rather than like give you clearance, why don't you let me score it and I'll do it for free. You know, I would love to score it. And that's kind of how my first score happened. And then from then on, my wife is also a filmmaker. And so she's kind of has a lot of documentary filmmaking friends. And so next after I did Tori's Distraction, I ended up doing this film called Wonder Woman, the untold stories of female heroines, and that came about from a connection from my wife, kind of like going out in her community asking for composers, new people to work with. So then my wife put my name in the hat for her, and you know, then I did that film, and then from doing that film, the producer on that film was producing another film, and then, you know, just so on and so forth. And that kind of happened. But I was always more interested in narrative. I felt really constrained by documentary, like, especially with my wife, a documentary filmmaker, and her kind of the films of hers that I've scored, you know, we've really, she does like social justice, you know, focused, documentaries. And, you know, you have to be really careful with music as far as in a documentary in general. You have to be really careful with music to not sway it and, you know, just kind of can't, I don't know. You don't want to take advantage of a character, I guess, and a character's story and taint and, you know, just kind of taint that with music that's a little too heavy or a little, whatever. So I was always more interested in narrative. And then leading into working with, you know, Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead. When I was recording in Iceland, my fourth record, Into the Blue Again, my manager thought it would be cool to make a video of me, you know, making this record. So he hired a camera guy. His name was Justin Benson. And he followed me around in the studio into Bear Creek, into Iceland, all over the place. I never knew him. I met him then. So he did that. We cut that film, you know, fast forward, I don't know, 6 years or so, 7 years. He's then now made Resolution. He's met Aaron. They made Resolution. They reached out when I moved to LA, saying, hey, they just wrote this script. And wrote it to Album Leaf and just wanted to talk to me about it. That was spring. And then, we cut like a little teaser for them to kind of get funding. And then that's kind of how that happened. And then we did The Endless and Synchronic and yeah.
And then
so that's
and
kind of,
he signed on to do Moon Knight, I think too, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. They're doing pretty good. So, and that's kind of been my trajectory with them, is just working with film, and I've done other, you know, narratives since then as well. But yeah, I have definitely a working relationship, you know, composer director relationship with them, and they're great to work with.
That's excellent. Well, you know, Synchronic kind of starts off with a bang. I want to say the intro is either the best anti-drug essay or the worst fragrance commercial ever. but what was the first, I mean, I'm sure they told you about the story before you saw anything, but what was the first piece of film that you actually started to put some music to, and what were some of the first thoughts about the palette?
Yeah, so I read the script early on, and I have a weird habit of not reading a full script. I like to read the first like 70% and then I stop. Almost like I don't like to know how it ends. I don't know. Or maybe I just get distracted. I don't know what it is, but like it continues to happen. Like every single time I'm gonna read this script, I make it, you know, that far and then I stop. But yeah, so I'd gotten the script early on, and then they shot. And they basically gave me a rough cut. And it's funny that you say it starts off with a bang, because that's not how the film actually started then. And that's not what our cut that we previewed at TIFF and stuff like that. That's not how it started. It started more, and there's a scene in the ambulance when they're sitting there and he's talking the stab victim that they first discover. Well, now that that's not what they first discover now, just because they rearranged. I've only saw the final cut once. I watched it the other night because it just came out. But I saw the previous cut many times. There's a scene in the ambulance with them. You know, he says like, my good, you know, Dennis and I, we were friends. We went to school together. Yada, yada, yada. It's like one of their patients passes away. That's how the film used to start. And then it immediately went to credits, and then the smack of the ambulance door after credits, as you see it now. The scene that now starts it was the top of act of Reel 2, basically, like 15 minutes later. But yeah, the palette, I just with each film I just start to really experiment. I mean, probably as we all do, just like with sounds, tones, drones. I primarily score with synths, so I start to like do a lot of design and start to kind of find new sounds and you know, stuff like that. So that's essentially what I did, and I knew that the drug I wanted to make. I kind of like, you know, obviously like mapped out all the key moments of characters and themes and sounds that I wanted to have. This also coincidentally was the first time that I was on three films at once. So it was my first time dealing with kind of doing three different scores. And I work alone, you know, I don't work with anyone else for the most part. I don't bring in anyone else till the kind of the end, but so that was kind of an interesting thing. So I really wanted to just start experimenting with the synthesizer and make, you know, key sounds for the drug, I guess, is what I was, you know, working on. So that kind of like established the tone. And then also like early on reading the script, knowing that it was set in New Orleans, wanting to have an ode to that, I had a whole idea of like using a lot of brass and using, you know, a lot of like kind of, you know, street percussion, like all the street, like the street performers that are in the New Orleans scene. That was my initial idea, and like trying to take those and manipulate that and stretch them and you know, just tweak them and make, you know, different sounds out of it. And then also I wanted to kind of have a nod to the like the voodoo you know, element of New Orleans and that. So I started like listening to like early 60s like kind of Haitian drumming and different things like that. And I know this doesn't make sense because there's not anything like that in the score, but what I did was I took those things. I sampled the rhythms, sound replaced, you know, and then slowed them way, 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 way down. And that's actually the drum rhythms that you do hear in the score, is that it's like they're slowed down like 48, tuned pitch down like 48 steps. So it's like this creates this really kind of crazy, sluggish, kind of falling apart drum rhythm that's not really like consistent at all. It happens in that first like one shot where they, you know, have the kind of the first discovery where you see them doing what they're actually doing in the film. And from there, it just kind of, you know, tying into the different themes that I had and the melodic elements, just kind of marrying the two and, you know, going back and forth between the, you know, the Steve's story, Dennis's story, you know, Tara's story and Brianna's story, all of them kind of having this, these separate stories, but all connected. They're obviously all connected, you know, cause they're all, you know, it all comes together where they're all essentially searching for, you know, Brianna. So just kind of putting together those elements and trying to figure out how to marry all of that, you know, like keeping the same kind of piano tone for both Tara and Brianna, and Dennis, like that kind of family story, kind of, you know, and then having like synthesis moments for, you know, anything kind of drug related and stuff like that, I guess. But yeah, I mean, it's funny as I was watching, cause it's like the first act, my wife and I watched it, it was the first time she saw it. And she's like, I can't figure out the tone of this. Cause the score is so, you know, just kind of like sluggish. And then it kind of hits, you know, like then you learn about the drug, you learn about what happens. You learn that he has, you know, this condition and why he's able to kind of do that. And then everything kind of starts to come together. But yeah, I mean, it's like a lot of just, I feel like I'm really, really slow to get started on a film because I'm doing so much experimenting. And then when I get to where I'm want to be, then I'm like, then it kind of starts to like roll out really quickly.
Well, cool. Well, you know, I think one of my favorite parts of the movie, and I don't know how much it means to you, but there's an elevator shaft scene.
Yes.
And I think it's just really cool how the music kind of follows the arc of the camera. What went into that, and what were the elements that you were kind of most excited about?
So this time it was really cool because I did work a lot with, so I had everything kind of like mapped out, like, you know, the score. And then I brought in there's a cellist that I normally work with, but she's located in New York. Her name is Clarice Jensen. And she's done a lot of cello and you know, arrangements for me just kind of remotely. And this time I felt like since there was moments like that, like the elevator shaft and different things that I wanted to kind of convey, like what my vision was, I searched for someone local. So I worked with this double bassist cellist, kind of wacky instrument musician named Gabe Noel. And he just like sat in the room right behind me and we watched and Aaron had mentioned early on, like they mentioned, Aaron and Justin are very kind of clear in their musical vision and their musical direction. And they give me a temp track, they'd give me a temp score. And it's a kind of funny joke between us because they gave me a temp score, but it doesn't matter because I never pay attention to it. It's just like wipes, it's totally wiped out. And if you go back, I always like thought that it would be a funny thing to like show a scene with my score as opposed to like what they had temped in because it's just worlds apart. But they trust me and that's what I love. And then, so they trust me to do what I want to do naturally, or what comes natural to a scene for me. At any rate, so early on, Aaron had mentioned Shepherd's Tone, which is the, you know, the basically the illusion that the note is always going up, like it never stops. It's just up, 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 up. And it never hits it obviously doesn't actually go all the way up, you know, but like there's just, you know, circles around. So there's like, if you can search videos on Shepherd's Tone, you guys are probably familiar with it, but for listeners, I guess. But so that was an idea of like wanting to do, there's a handful of scenes and they do this a lot in the film too, where they pan up. and or they pan down. They do that a lot with the camera, just in their approach to filmmaking. And also the mirrored cuts too, where like you see, you know, Steve or an object sitting in a place, and then it cuts to the same exact thing, and it is the same exact position, and it's, you know, different scene.
Like an ambulance or in the MRI.
Exactly. Yeah. And the original cut for that actually opening scene that starts off with a bang was intercut with the MRI things, and so you would see these. I mean, they showed like it starts with like you see an image on the TV, and then it cuts right to her drawing the same image, and you know, think they have these cuts, and that's kind of like what shaped that cue. It was like kind of this sound coming up, and then with the cut shifting and turning into, you know, filtered version and tailing off really quickly and all those cuts. Anyhow, so there was those moments like that, like the pan up, and I wanted to kind of have, you know, the illusion of a shepherd's tone. It happens again when they discover Brianna's missing and Dennis is standing outside calling Tara on the phone, and then says she's missing, and then all of a sudden a drone shoots straight up into the sky, and that's another moment where it goes, you know, kind of those moments. So I guess, you know, wanting to find a way to follow that idea of theirs of just, you know, the camera panning that they do. So that whole thing. And I wanted the strings to go down, but, you know, because the camera's going down, but the anticipation of what you're going to see is from the vocal of her going and going up, you know, as the strings are going down. So that's kind of the idea.
No, that's great. That's awesome.
That is cool. The synchronic score is just, I loved it. I remember seeing it back in 2019.
So you saw the first cut then, probably.
I did, yeah. I think it was Fantastic Fest is where they showed it at. Yeah, yeah. So it was good. And I remember, you know, the score and all that good stuff. So, So awesome. What's next for you?
I have another.
Can you talk about it?
I guess I don't know if I can or not, but you know,
we won't tell anybody.
Yeah. I'm starting work on another film soon. I don't know if I can or can't say anything about it, but you know, those guys are always up to something, so they can't not make movies. I'm signing with a new label and going to release a lot of this music that I've been sitting on and figuring out how to do that. Trying to embrace, I have a live stream performance next Friday. So I'm trying to kind of embrace and figure out how to kind of navigate in the music world. The lack of touring is good for me too, because, you know, as I said earlier, I have two kids and I've been touring since 1996, and I love playing shows, but I don't necessarily love being gone. I love traveling. I love touring, but I don't like the length of time, you know, that I kind of have to put into it. So this situation is kind of good for me to kind of try to embrace and, so I have that. I also never publicly acknowledged that I did the sound design for the new for Beats headphones.
What? Really?
Yeah.
Let's talk about that.
Oh my
sure,
goodness.
Yeah. So when you put on, like, they have a new line of Power Beats, which are the Bluetooth. They're in a little case. I normally have them around, but they're upstairs. And there's a connection sound and a disconnect sound, and I did those sounds.
That's badass. Does that mean you worked with like Apple and Dre and everything?
I mean, not Dre, but yeah, but with Apple. I mean, the backstory of that is that I was actually brought in like back in 2013, I want to say, the then president of Beats, not you know, Dre or Jimmy Iovine, but the then president of Beats, Luke Wood, was an Almley fan. And when he first started with Beats, he listened to In a Safe Place all the time in China, like traveling back and forth and doing his thing. And so he brought me in 2013, stating like some really specific things, like, you know, wanting to redo the sounds. The original sounds for the Beats line, like the was done by the forget his name, Jared or something like, from AFI. Forget what his actual name is, but a guy from AFI, the band AFI. And Luke brought me in like 2013 to like talk about doing new sounds. And I was like, oh, this is great. Of course. Like, that'd be really cool. And kind of not intimidating in any way, shape or form to, you know, to create sounds that Dre is going to hear or some, you know, or Jimmy Iovine and these guys that are like producers of great music and great records and all of those things. At any rate, so it happened, that meeting happened and then years went by and nothing happened. Turns out it was in the middle of like kind of the sale to Apple, and kind of that whole thing. And then Luke reached, but somebody from Beats reached out and said, hey, you know, Luke asked me to reach out to start the process of doing new sounds, new tones. So then it took a long, really long time, not because of the creation, but because of just kind of the back and forth and the tiers and the hierarchy, you know, just whatever, like how things worked. But yeah, so I did these basically, I did like 18 different cues. I mean, I did hundreds of cues because I mean, literally it's like, how do you put something into like a literal second? You know, like it's just, it took so long to just wrap my head around that. I'm just like, boom, no, that's not interesting. Boom, that's still not interesting. Like, what do I do? You know, I mean, and in the long run, I mean, it's like, there's like, it's like a boom, boom, you know, that's like the connection sound. Mm-hmm. And then the disconnect is, and kind of, you know, pitch shifts down. And I mean, and there is like a lot of thought behind like what those things were, and it's just a trip. So, at any rate, still working with Beats. So, you know, making sounds, and they came out and I just kind of never really said anything. I didn't really post it like, hey, I made these sounds. I'm not really best on social media to begin with. So, you know,
but hey, that's badass. Yeah. That's totally pretty big. Yeah. That's great.
It was very cool. It's nice on my resume, I guess, but
for sure. We'll put that out on their resume, put some beats out there. I got to ask, since you've been in the music realm since you were four playing piano prodigy style,
Beethoven at four.
are there any like really strange weird recordings that you own, whether it be like a something you orchestrated or like an album that's like, oh, I found this in Japan and holy shit, it's weird and I love it?
I have an old four track tape of my old band from high school. There's plenty of weird voice memos that I've recorded. I don't know how weird. I mean, I bet they're pretty weird, but I'm like, for me, it's just like, oh, I remember this. but I'm sure to probably anybody else would be like, what is this? This is nuts, you know. But there's actually a little clip. There was this cassette documentary that I have a scene in, and it's me kind of going through my old four track cassettes from my old bands in high school, and there's a clip of me discovering and playing this old band of mine that actually and I'm singing, and it's just kind of funny where I'm just like my lyrics, like everything was just like, whoa, what is that all about? And it's just kind of, I'm screaming, you know, it's like that era. So
yeah,
it's kind of funny.
That's great. And I gotta ask, are there any particular musical cues in any song like that you love, or a music moment in a film that has always stuck with you?
These are always the times where I draw massive blanks.
we should have emailed you these beforehand.
But I should also like have my go-to of like, yep, it's this.
Tattoo your other arm.
Yeah.
Led Zeppelin, the Shags.
Yeah, totally. you know, there's moments that I don't really, I don't know. Like for instance, like singing songs to my kids, like I said earlier, like with and you know, playing guitar and like singing to them. There's some of those songs just like all of a sudden hit a little like choke spot in me where I'm just like, ooh, I don't know. And if I don't know if it's like the time and what we're living in and what was going on and what's happening. And my, you know, being so kind of just like torn of my kids' mental health with, you know, we're here, you know, it's been almost a year of this, you know, things like that, that really kind of like get me. And I mean, score moments, like I don't, when I think about Johan Johansson and it's not kind of like what, you know, his emotional stuff, but I feel like I feel like in scoring in general, and this is maybe alluding to the like me having not paid attention, like I said earlier, like I didn't really think about a composer. I didn't think it was a thing. I didn't know that like people made movie for films, you know, there's music for films and music for TV, and it was a thing, you know, and people sat there and they like, you know, created these, you know, worlds. But I feel like in the last 10 years, the composing game has changed so much. And it's because of the entry of, you know, indie artists that have like kind of entered the scoring realm. Johan Johansson and even like, you know, Dustin O'Halloran and, you know, and these are all friends and peers of mine too. You know, Johan obviously has passed, but something... even like Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, like this, you know, the Watchmen, I think is like one of the coolest, like just vibes of, you know, of a show. And it shouldn't work because of the score, but it, like, because of the elements of the score, the tone, like the synthesis of the score, but it's like, so it's perfect. It like just makes that show, you know, and I feel like because of that, I for some reason trace it back to, and I'm sure it happened before, but my main like thing that stood out with me was Johan's Sicario score. And like that scene of the first kind of caravan into Mexico, through the border, to wherever they were like going through Juarez and just like into that whole, you know, like that first thing. And there's like this drum that's just starts filtered and just opens up. I feel like, I don't know what that has always stood out with me. For me, just as like a game changer in the scoring world, you know, and I feel like these artists these composers that come from an artist band background, going into the scoring realm, like Colin Stetson, Hilder, and Mika Levi, and you know, these kinds of composers. That also is like the Under the Skin soundtrack is incredible. But I feel like those composers entering the world of film and being noticed and having some notoriety and recognition has also changed the Top Gun's approach to scoring. Like I feel like Hans Zimmer's scores have changed and Desplat's, you know, scores have changed and kind of like got to keep up with the kids in a sense, you know, which I feel like is really great. So I feel like the scoring world and Ludwig Göransson's, his, you know, doing Black Panther. I mean, like, that's insane. Like, you know, that score is so, so cool. And Mandalorian score is super cool too. Anyway, I mean, I just feel like there's these younger guns, these younger, really strong composers with new voices. They're just like killing it and really challenging the older composers, approach, you know? And for me, I feel like the way I want to fit into that is that I'm not your piano strings composer, you know, like that's not what I want to do. That's not what I'm going to do, which is like kind of the formula, you know, a lot of like, you know, typical films just have the kind of piano violin and it's beautiful and it works. And there's a reason why that formula is there and people do it really, really great. And I kind of want to have a different voice in the scoring world for me. But yeah, I just feel like it's a really exciting time for, you know, even bands and music and you know, artists. I just think music has gotten really exciting over the last 10 years or so. And I'm not sure what's the difference in that. I mean, it's technology, things that are available to people, instruments, electronics, you know, progression and things that are created and, you know, stuff like that. So, I have no idea what you asked me to get me into that.
No, it was the best musical moments. No, that was great.
Right. That's okay.
Great.
Yeah.
But yeah, thank you. Mark, do you have a last question or?
Yeah, I do. Speaking to what you said about how music has grown and expanded in the past 10 years, I guess you can attribute it that to point of entry has been economically reduced, you know, with DIY exactly. And recording it your own, putting on YouTube. All that said, you were the second guest on Song Exploder, a podcast right. which has since blown up to over 200 more interviews. If you could pick another song that means a lot to you or has some impact in your life, do you want to, not to take any, like, not we're going to explode it, but what's another song that you think you would want to talk about if you had the opportunity?
You know... I feel, I don't know. It's tough. I have 20 plus year catalog to go back, to think about those things, but I always like resonate with like my most recent, work. So, as far as like Album Leaf is concerned, like my last record, is like the record that probably, I mean, if I'm being honest, did the worst and is my favorite, you know, and that's probably just, you know, it's the times or whatever, but I mean, it was like my least successful record, I guess, and my most favorite. And it was because of the way I created that record. And so I think any, you know, really some of those songs, like maybe Between Waves or New Soul or something like that, or even like Glimmering Lights off of that record. And it's really more of the, like the creation process and like the inspiration that I got from, the collaboration of, how I made that record, and taking just performances and utilizing just modern tools that I was able to do, to kind of create just the way in which I created that record, and in general, was really kind of an inspiring, exciting process. For me, it was like new discovery of how to make a record, you know, as opposed to like the traditional sense of like, you know, either getting in a room and tracking one by one or tracking all together. And, you know, this was more of a, just parts and pieces that were just played and recorded and then arranged into the final product, and utilizing kind of like, yeah, just you know, not hitting record and like playing and then be like, oh, I messed up, stop, go back, you know, that kind of thing. So yeah, I mean, anything kind of that process, I think, was really exciting to me. But specific song, I don't know.
Well, I hope that whole process, like you said, even though it was not your best received record, but it meant a lot to you. I hope that gives you the inspiration to keep going and doing things like, you know, Spring, oh, yeah. Endless, yeah. And Synchronic. So congratulations.
Right. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Jimmy, for being on the show. The spotlight is on you now. In the vein of your favorite pro wrestler, please tell everybody where they can find you online.
Well, no, I don't know. I mean, yeah, I'm in everywhere, basically at The Album Leaf. Social media is at The Album Leaf, and I have a JimmyLaval.com site as well as an AlbumLeaf.com site. And Jimmy Laval's site and focuses more on my composing stuff or world. But yeah, and then when does this air?
Could be tomorrow if you play your cards right. What I mean by that is we need to hear the beats. Beats power up and power down. You've got a piano to your left. Can you dazzle us?
Well, I'll say they're a little bit more. What I can do is I can probably play them through my system and you would hear it. but anyways, Well, yeah, I was going to say that, on all the normal, socials at the Album Leaf, et cetera. And then, but I'm playing a, live stream next week.
It'll be up January before 2nd. Then. So we can tell everybody to go there.
Yeah. Did you hear that?
Or no.
Okay. Let me hang on. you will get it. Zoom to queue. Right? Yeah, I have to go through and
there it is.
Yes. Did you hear it?
Yeah, I did hear it.
All right, there you go. And then there's Zeus.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Exclusive.
Thank you. I hope, oh my God, how amazing would it be if Jimmy, you went out on stage, big presentation, and that was the only thing you played. Thank you very much, everybody.
Oh my God, yeah. It's the best. That would be the best. That would be the ultimate.